You are tearing me apart, Lisa!
My girlfriend sucked 37 dicks.
In a row?
Hey, buddy, you gonna eat that sausage?
No, go past this. Past this part. In fact, never play this again.
Tell me something, my friend.
Am I the only one around here who gives a shit about the role?
Ladies and gentlemen!
Your complete attention, if you please.
The Epic Film Guys Podcast.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to a brand new episode of the Epic Film Guys Podcast. It's episode 167, and we are going to have one hell of a good time tonight. I am Nick.
One hell of a goddamn good time on this show, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Epic Film Guy Justin.
You know, you can talk over it all you want, but I can still hear the
can. We don't have to introduce him this way anymore. I'm not going to introduce you this way anymore. You're on the show so much. Yes, you're the god of podcasting. I'm not going to welcome you to the show. You can just introduce yourself and say hi. Can you just say hi?
I want to see kid get strangled.
Well, that's one way of saying hi, I guess.
Hi.
Boy Sauce has joined us this evening. We are graced by his presence.
We are graced by the presence of the god of podcasting. And before we get anywhere, gentlemen, I got to stop the show, full stop, right now. Huge, huge congratulations to our brother down in Perth. Paul from the Countdown just got engaged, man. Congratulations, brother. Woo-hoo. His very longtime girlfriend, Patsy. Congratulations to both of them.
What a wonderful feeling.
Yeah, that's absolutely amazing. We are not going to have any wonderful feelings tonight because we are going to just review a bunch of movies and talk about Bryan Singer's pool parties. And it's going to make us feel icky and nasty and gross. And
hey, Boy Sauce went to one of them, didn't you? Or you said you wanted to go to one of them, right?
You're putting words in my mouth. I never said that.
Oh, yes, ladies and gentlemen, full review of Bryan Singer / _ Dexter Fletcher's Bohemian Rhapsody. Justin and the Sauce are going to be talking about the new Suspiria. Ooh, and the Sauce and I are going to get deep, and I mean in-depth review of the Nutcracker. And
Nuts deep.
Fucking balls
deep. I was just waiting for it.
Balls deep. But we got so much stuff to talk about tonight on the show.
It's going to be a full-tilt boogie episode.
It's really going to be a full-tilt boogie episode. And we're going to kick things off by talking about our November challenge, fourth year running. Ladies and gentlemen, it's time.
Never seen it, November.
That is just, my God.
How did we not get a record deal already?
I'm just shocked.
When's your mixtape dropping?
But of course, our challenge for the month of November, watch 10 films you've never seen before. That's all you have to do. And we're giving away prizes. But you can find out about those over in the Hopester's Dumpster. Please head over there and check in your picks. Just 10 films all month long. And Justin, I think you actually might be in the lead right now. I think you're 7 films in already.
That's right, I am. And a few titles out of those 7 that I've decided to watch so far, outside of one of the films that we're going to be talking, the 2 of the films we're going to be talking about tonight, I actually got a chance to watch King Cohen, the documentary, the amazing documentary about legendary cult filmmaker Larry Cohen. I got to watch Brian De Palma's Blowout. I got to watch To Hell and Back, the Kane Hodder story, which is about Kane Hodder, who is Jason Voorhees. He is Jason Voorhees. Every fan that loves Friday the 13th, he is Jason Voorhees to you. And I got a chance, of course, Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2. Thank God that is over. I am very happy that is in my past.
Hey.
And I watched tonight 1962's classic starring Frank Sinatra, The Manchurian Candidate, which I've been looking forward to watching for years. So I'm off to a really great start. I'm really excited about this month. Like I was saying in the patron-only segment, Nick, I felt very intimidated last month. Horror is my thing, as you guys all know. But we had Corey Wade in there, Scott LaVar, Drew. you guys were just destroying it last month during the horror challenge, and I just knew I could never catch up to you guys. Craziness. So I was just like, fuck it. I'm just going to watch as much as I can watch and just enjoy it. But that's why it's there. We have these challenges for you guys to enjoy and for you guys to just watch as many movies as you possibly can and have a blast. So appreciate all that. But Nick, what have you got a chance to watch so far?
Well, aside from Loy Sauce and I will talk momentarily about, again, in-depth review of The Nutcracker and the Four Realms, ladies and gentlemen. But aside from that, and of course Bohemian Rhapsody, I also got the chance to check out Orson Welles' The Other Side of the Wind, which dropped on Netflix. And I went in depth with our good friends over at Netflix and Swill, Dan and Caleb. They had me on the show this week. It's already released by the time you'll hear this, so go check that out. But it's basically two movies in one. It kind of recaps the events leading up to, you know, the death of a famous director at his 70th birthday party. And meanwhile, there's a meta film that takes place within the film, which is essentially just Oya Kadar nude for about 45 straight minutes. I shit you not. And there's so many things to say about it, and it would take me probably the next 20 minutes to really flesh out even more thoughts than I did on their show, so I won't go that deep, but I did very highly recommend it, especially if you're somebody who adores Orson Welles like I do. The party stuff, it's shot in 4:3 aspect ratio, and what he did, he basically shoots it as if there's a ton of different people with all sorts of different cameras, 8mm cameras, 16mm cameras, at a party. And so it's very frantic, and it cuts between all these different shots at the same party. And John Huston stars as Jake Hannaford, the director, and he's trying to get funding to complete Other Side of the Wind, which is the meta film within it. And it's an experience. I'll definitely say that. I don't necessarily know how well this film would play with modern audiences, or if you're not necessarily a cinephile who can go into it and try to appreciate the things in it. But for somebody like me who adores Orson Welles, I hated the meta film, but I think as an audience member, you're supposed to hate the meta film. And like I said, the party stuff, especially with John Huston, he gives a fantastic performance. Really, really worth checking out. So that was basically it for my Never Seen It November, aside from the other films we'll talk about. But Loy Sauce, what have you been checking out for the month so far?
I think the only other film that I've logged so far that we're not going to talk about tonight is Happy Death Day, which I very much enjoyed. I missed that when it came out last year, and I've heard a lot of people praise it in the horror community, so I checked it out, and I was really charmed by it. I started out a little bit annoyed, but once it gets going, I was kind of won over by it. Wish it were a little more bloody, a little more gory, because as you know, I love my gore in my movies. But yeah, it was just really gory. Well done. Like semi-original concept in terms of, I mean, it's Groundhog Day.
How can it not be gory when it's literally, you know, the main character just dies over and over until she tries to, like, she's trying to figure out who kills her, and like she just dies
PG-13.
And then starts to say over.
13.
Oh man, get out of town.
Yeah, but that is lamentable, but, you know, it works in spite of itself, you know, it works in spite of the kind of watered down rating. It manages to be completely charming. I thought it was funny. I laughed a lot. The main character starts out as the most unlikable human being ever, and then throughout the course of the film, you learn to really...
As Justin?
Hey, now.
What, Lorraine? What?
She becomes really sympathetic and likable as the movie goes along. So, I don't know. I would recommend it to anyone who is a fan of horror films, slasher films, because it does kind of deconstruct those.
And we're getting another one. We're getting a sequel already. They just announced we're getting Happy Death Day to You.
A direct sequel, which I thought was interesting, because I'm like, what more can they do with that concept? But the fact that it's the same kind of characters and everything makes it kind of... Like, I wonder where they're going
to
take it.
I guess you'll just have to wait and see. So we're going to get into this really in depth, and we're going to talk about The Nutcracker and The Four Realms. And Justin and Loisos, again, they have Suspiria. We're going to do that after What Are You Drinking? But I figure, Loisos, let's get this fucking shit out of the way.
Let me do my
job. Stop it, you wing, you baby! Shut up!
You guys can't see this because you're the podcast audience who's listening, but Justin was pantomiming all of the different voice clips during that sound drop, which was hilarious. This movie was fucking garbage. I said when I came out of it, I said I adore, and I mean adore, the costume design, the production design, and the music in this film. I think they're top notch, literally just amazing. But the problem with this film is it's 99 minutes long, and it takes about 45-50 of those minutes to do literally anything plot related. Anything.
Well, because the whole movie's exposition. The whole movie is literally explaining what the backstory and the plot is. And the plot itself doesn't really kick in until the last act.
Yeah, really.
The last third of it.
The plot is literally crammed into the last act of the film. Like, the last 35 minutes is like, oh, right, we were supposed to be telling a story here. That thing that a movie is supposed to do. It's just, it's not good. It's just not good.
Well, okay, so this is kind of a trend that Disney has done. It's essentially the Nutcracker in Wonderland, or the Nutcracker, the Great and Powerful. It is very much in that same vein of Disney taking a beloved story, you know, Alice in Wonderland, the Wizard of Oz, and making it into essentially like an action blockbuster. The movie kind of starts out very charming. It starts out basically telling the story of the Nutcracker. You know, you have Clara and a party at Drosselmeyer's, and, you know, he gives her the nut, you know, well, she's not gifted the Nutcracker. She's gifted a Fabergé egg, and she can't open it because she's missing a key. And so the whole movie is her traveling into Narnia. Oh, I'm sorry. To Wonderland. Oh, I'm sorry. The Four Realms. Trying to find this key. And that's not really an exciting, like, it's basically like a treasure hunt film. What do they call it in video games? Like a quest?
Yep, fetch quest.
Fetch quest. Yeah, that's essentially what this movie is. And it's just not very engaging. And it, of course, like all of these movies have to end, they have to end in a giant battle. And I'm like, where did the Nutcracker is such a simple little tale. This is just, it's so overblown, and it's extremely, if you've seen like Alice in Wonderland, like you've seen this movie. It just
takes an eternity. And I mean that legitimately. It's 99 minutes long, and it felt like an eternity before anything actually happens in this film, because it sets up this whole backstory of the girl and her family. And then we have to set up the whole backstory of the Four Realms, and we have to learn, like, all, like, literally, it's, Lois House is not kidding, it's somebody just drove a tractor trailer full of fucking exposition up and just dumped it. Like, literally, for 25 straight minutes. Like, there's a whole, like, there's actually a ballet sequence in the film, because it's the Nutcracker. So
which is the best part of the film.
Ballet sequence is all exposition. That's all it is explaining the fucking backstory. And the dancing is gorgeous. It's amazing. And there were practical sets. I loved that it was actual stage sets that they were using during that scene.
Yeah.
But it was all just exposition, just to explain the backstory for this plot that they were going to just throw us into needlessly.
Yeah, like, well, there is the ballet sequence, and you want to enjoy like the music and the dancing, but it's hard to because people are talking over it, and who is talking over it but Keira Knightley doing this like helium squeaky voice throughout the entire picture.
Mousy voice, yeah. It would have been much better suited, I think, to just basically drop you into the land of the Four Realms and just exposit and let you learn about the Four Realms as it goes through the plot.
There's no sense of discovery at all.
None. It's a montage. There's a montage of her touring the realms and like visiting the different realms. That's how quick it throws it away.
Why do there even have to be four realms?
I don't even know. But I'm throwing a 4 out of 10 on it. Like I said, I love the production design. I love the music. I love the costume work. Everything else about this movie is just fetid, stinking, rotten garbage. I'm not the audience for this film. I know that, but
you're not.
No,
because Disney, it's a Disney film. Like, Disney films are supposed to be all encompassing.
Yeah.
You could take grandma to a Disney film. You could take, you know, the whole family to see a Disney film.
If you have,
I feel like
little kids, they'll probably, in the last act at least, sort of enjoy it. Little kids would be bored to death with this movie, though. They'd hate it. They'd hate it because it's so much setup and it's so much needless exposition. It's just, it's not good. Lois, what would you rate it?
it just feels like a hodgepodge. This film went through tons of reshoots. Originally, it was directed by Lasse Hallström and then was replaced by Joe Johnston halfway through filming. And they scrapped a lot of footage and reshot a lot of footage with a new script. And that's exactly what it feels like. It feels like a movie made by committee to please a family audience. I will be giving this movie a 5 out of 10. Just as...
Booyah.
Middle of the road as humanly possible.
100%.
To me, it's not a good film. It's not a bad film. It's a movie that I watched and I will forget about
it certainly
tomorrow.
Is a movie. Well, ladies and gentlemen, not recommending Nutcracker in the Four Realms.
No. But well, although you could do much, you could take your family to much worse.
Yeah, you could have gone to see the Happy Time Murders. Not
you could
your
take
family.
Your family to you could take your family to see that awful looking Grinch movie.
Womp,
don't
womp.
Do it. Don't do it. That is sacrilegious, ladies and gentlemen. Do not womp, tarnish womp, the name of the womp. Grinch.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we've got a lot more stuff to pack in just in this segment alone. So we're going to rush right over into What Are You Drinking?
I'm back. Puke and rally. Woo! Give me a beer.
We haven't heard from Justin in a hot minute. Hot minute, because he was just thinking about, he was actually probably ordering tickets to the Nutcracker and the Four Realms there while we were talking about it, because he wants to see the mice. It's number one. But Justin, tell us what you're sipping from your Singer Sucker.
I got to give a huge shout out to my boy, P-Well, Brian Powell, good friend of the show, supporter of the show. We did a beer trade this last week. I sent him some Aslan. He sent me some Trillium Brewing Company and some Treehouse. And what I have right now is the Trillium Brewing Company scaled up double IPA, 8% alcohol by volume. And there's a smell, Nick. You know, you've had Trillium beers. As soon as you open that can and you pour it into a glass, it's Trillium. You can't mistake that smell for any other brewery. And I love this beer. It finishes up with a dry and smooth finish and a very light bitterness, but a perfect bitterness to this beer. It's probably, I would say, my top five of the Trillium beers that I've ever had. But while I have this opportunity on the air, I got to thank you, Brian Powell, because you surprised me. You gave me the biggest surprise that anyone's ever given me in a package with beer. In the bottom of the package of beer, he sent me a Michael Myers NECA action figure that's from like 10 years ago that I've been after for literally 10 years. It's extremely expensive. It's extremely rare. And I've never been able to afford to get it. I never told him I was after it. And he just literally slipped it in there. Saucy, you were here. I literally fell to my knees and shrieked in excitement when I saw that it was in the box because I never would have thought.
It was quite unlike anything I've ever seen.
So while I'm on the air, just got to show my appreciation for my buddy, P-Well. You're the man.
Awesome. Aww. That is amazing. And over to, ladies and gentlemen, the god of podcasting, the maimer of children, or well, I guess he just wants to watch children get maimed. He's more of a watcher, not a doer.
I would never maim a child. Aww. I just like watching it on screen in my films.
Ray.
Yes. So this is the beer that I've had on the show the last like three times. It's my last one. It's my very last one. So I'll be getting new beer.
Your favorite, Nick, your favorite kind of beer.
It's the Schaffley Pumpkin Ale. I don't have anything more to say about it. It's my last one. So no more pumpkin beer for me.
That's right. I think this weekend I'm going to be roasting the pumpkin.
Yeah, baby.
My pumpkin pie beer, giving it my best effort. But I got to take a moment and a huge, huge shout out here to one Thomas Coe of Jake and Tom Conquer the World, who I love talking beer with him. We especially love to talk about Founders beers. So as soon as I saw this beer in stores, I had to get it at a fucking hefty price tag too. So I probably will not be getting another one of these, even though I'm enjoying the shit out of it. It is Founders CBS, their Canadian breakfast stout, brewed with chocolate and coffee, aged in maple syrup bourbon barrels. I swear to God, if this is what angel semen tasted like, I would believe you, because I feel like I'm sucking off an angel.
Gross.
You're
the
flying,
show's in
man.
A weird
Are you
place
flying?
Tonight. With,
Are you flying?
We're talking about Bryan Singer tonight, so the show's in a really weird place, sexually, I guess. But yeah, it voice off his face right now, guys. It is an incredible beer, just absolutely amazing. The chocolate notes are so prominent. Justin, what do I hate when they do coffee stouts too much coffee and a stale coffee taste. The coffee is very muted here. It's not very prominent. And of course, you get that sweetness from the maple syrup and you get that oakiness of bourbon. It's just mouthfeel. You want to talk about mouthfeel?
Mouthfeel?
He doesn't even have to say it anymore. I can just push a button. It's incredible. If you see this, you will pay for it. It costs a lot, but it is worth every single penny. I promise you. I promise. So, gentlemen, I'm going to enjoy my CBS while I fade into the background here, and you guys are going to talk about a little movie that doesn't play in my market and probably never will. The brand new Suspiria.
Well, I love the original Suspiria, and I approached this remake with excitement, anticipation. I thought the trailers were fantastic. The cast, of course, is just phenomenal. And Luca Guadagnino is a director who I have enjoyed his works in the past. I liked I Am Love. I liked Call Me By Your Name, A Bigger Splash. So he is a director that I thought was kind of perfect for this because he said, I'm going to do my own interpretation. It looked vastly different. He wasn't going to use any of the original music or anything. It was very much his own film. And I appreciated that sense of vision that he had for this material. So I saw this at an early screening, and a very early screening. I saw it like 2 months ago, thereabouts. When I first saw it, I was extremely frustrated because I didn't get it. And I figured, well, I'd like to see it again because I feel like maybe there's some subtext that I missed. Maybe there's some plot holes that will become more clear to me on a second viewing. And then I watched it a second time with you this past weekend. And so I've seen it twice now. And part of me wishes I hadn't seen it at all. This is one of the most frustrating movie watching experiences I think I've ever had. Because you can see so much potential on screen, and there are moments of it that leave you positively spellbound and shook and just wrapped with the imagery on screen. And the rest of it is boring and nonsensical and flat and silly. So I struggle with this film a lot because what it could have been. I mourn for this film.
Wow. I can relate to that, man. I really can. When you originally kind of gave me the hint after you saw it that you weren't jumping for joy based on your experience with it, it had me a little bit worried. I was definitely on the edge of my seat waiting to hear like an amazing reaction. Yes, it's what we all thought it was going to be. Because those trailers, man, they really knocked it out of the park. I mean, as you said, very rightly so, it looks totally different. And I approach this, for those of you guys that listen to the show normally, but if you're new, you don't know this, I want something different. If you're going to remake something, I want you to make it your own. I want you to go back to the original concept, the original story outline, and say, I know what I can do with this to make it my own and do something completely different. I don't want it to look like the original. Sure, have that feeling there. Make it connect in some way, but I want you to do something different with it. And I think Guadagnino does that. He's almost there. My main issue with this movie, and I know a lot of people are talking about this on social media, is the length. This movie goes and goes and goes.
It's almost 2.5 hours.
And it's painful
over,
for me.
Over 2.5 hours.
There's some extremely excruciating scenes in this, brutal scenes, but it was almost more brutal for me to have to sit through it because there are scenes, Brian, where it's just a scene of dialogue that never connects to anything else in the movie. Like, why am I watching this scene of two girls in a bedroom talking for 5 minutes? You could slice that off. I feel like the movie really could have done with a better edit, maybe cut it down 30 minutes even. I would say maybe even 35 minutes, cut it 35 minutes down, and you'd have a brisker, better movie because, as you said perfectly, there is imagery in this movie that is some of my favorite imagery out of any movie I've seen this entire year. There is amazing sequences of brutality. The horror is there. And yes, ladies and gentlemen, this is an art house horror film. This isn't another Conjuring movie, and it's not a straight up art house film. I think Guadagnino was really doing his best attempt at blending an art house with a horror film and still making it impactful to the horror audience. And unfortunately, me being that audience, it just didn't work for me.
Because I love horror films, and I love weirdo, complex art house films. So I thought that if there were ever a movie that would be 100% my shit, it'd be this one. And I see all of these pull quotes from critics saying, like, one of the best, most complex movies of the year. And I saw one that was like, this movie will change your life. And, like, I want to be that person that champions this film. To me, I just felt like nothing really connected. Nothing really clicked with me. There are two amazing sequences. And I guess we'll talk about what the movie is all about and where these sequences fit in. But it takes place at a dance academy in Berlin in the 70s, and Dakota Johnson plays Susie Banyan, who goes to this this dance academy, and basically just this darkness engulfs her as she discovers that it's run by a coven of witches, basically. I feel like it's a much more grounded take. It's very muted. All the colors are muted, as opposed to the original, which is, you know, just awash with neon and, you know, goblins music. And this is a very much more subdued take on it, which, again, I appreciate. But it's boring.
It really is. I mean, that's the one thing I took away from this. Not all of it is. There's some really interesting scenes here. But I think one of my main issues that I walked away from with this is one of the main characters, the psychiatrist.
Yes, played by Tilda Swinton, playing a male psychotherapist, Dr. Oh, man.
Josef Klemperer.
Klemperer, yeah.
It's insane because I think the makeup job was brilliantly done. But the character, just, I never felt any, like, connection to the character. And I think that's supposed to be the only character in the film that we're attaching ourselves to or being able to relate to. Not that you need to, in this kind of movie, relate to somebody or connect to them, but I feel like he was presented to us as that one character. His story is supposed to be very important. And what I don't like is that the film continues to do flashbacks to this incident where there was a plane hijacking and these people that were taken hostage. And I understand where they were trying to go with that, but this isn't the movie that I want to see that in. It just
they're trying to put you more in the period of what was going on during that time, the turmoil that was going on in Berlin, and they're trying to ground the movie in some sort of socio-political context. Like, I understand what they're going for, because it kind of, on my second watch, it kind of became clear to me that the parallels of what's going on inside the dance studio
is what's going on outside the dance studio. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. But, like, so what? I don't know. It never really connects for me. There is a certain sense of tragedy with Dr. Klemperer and his story. But again, like, what does that have to do with the story that we're watching for a majority of the movie, which is Susie Banyan and the goings-on at the dance academy?
We have to get to it right now. We got to get to that, the mirror scene, the dance studio with the mirrors around it, the scene everyone talked about in those early screenings. It's horrific.
Yeah, it's the best scene in the movie for sure. It peaks early because this happens very early on in the film.
Well, like 35, 40 minutes into the movie.
Right. And
where we see one of the dancers, one of her friends has just left. She's worried about her. They know something's gone wrong, and she's fed up. And during a rehearsal, she just storms out. And upon leaving, she is drawn to this room, and her body just begins contorting and crushing itself, like compacting itself. And as the dance in the other room is going on, her body is twisting itself around based on those dance moves.
Like a pretzel.
The scenes are happening simultaneously, and it cuts back and forth between the two. And I thought it was brilliantly done. Like, the tension, the buildup in that sequence, and the horror. It's extremely unnerving. It's extremely uncomfortable to watch. And at the end of it, we're seeing this young lady pissing herself, drools coming out of her mouth. Her neck is broken. Her arms are behind her back, twisted like a pretzel, as you said. And it's probably one of the most impressive scenes I've seen in a horror film not just all year, Brian, but in years. That's why this movie is so frustrating, because it has something so amazing in it, something that me and you should turn to each other in the movie theater and say, this is for us. This is a blessing for us. This is what we've always wanted, like, and inhale it. But the rest of the movie doesn't ever get back to that level of being brutal and shocking.
No. And scenes such as that, which are very few and far between, are directly followed by a dry patch of nothing happening. I mean, the pacing is all over the shop. I could never imagine myself sitting through this movie again, because it is so boring and pretentious.
Well, yes.
And using the word pretentious to describe this film, but there are just so many moments where I was like, oh my gosh, Guadagnino is just jacking himself off here. There's so much that just doesn't add anything other than, oh, you know, here's an artsy flourish. And I'm like, fuck you.
I feel like it's 60% artsy, 40% horror. And if it was 60% horror, 40% artsy, something like Hereditary, that we both adored and loved and is still on our top 10 list of the year so far, then we'd be perfectly set off. Cinematography is done amazingly in this movie. The look of this movie, and I cannot say his name to save my life, Sayambu Makidam, it's done amazingly. There are shots in this where we did turn to each other on many occasions and just look at each other in awe over how brilliant it looked. There's one scene I'm going to talk about before we finish up here, because we have way more to talk about in the show, where two policemen go to investigate one of the girls, Chloe Grace Moretz's character, vanishing from the school. And you could see that the headmistress witches bring them into a room and they're just toying with them. And they pull out one of their hooks and they just have the man's penis hanging out the whole time. And they're putting the hook around the penis. And I almost thought they were going to chop that thing into a fucking hot dog and eat it, man. I swear to God. That's the silliness that I was like, this is charming to me. I'm glad this is in there, because the rest of it would have been way too serious and way too cold and just sterile for me. Let's finish this off, ladies and gentlemen. This is it. We both love the original. The original is a classic. We all knew.
Argento, all right? Man. It's one of the best horror movies ever made.
We knew. See, those of you out there that are like, it sucks, it's nowhere near the original. It doesn't need to be near the original.
No, it doesn't.
We're not asking for that. But what we just want it to be is a good movie in its own right. And it almost got there. That's why it's a frustrating experience for the both of us. I'm going to stamp my rating on it. I'm going to give it a 6 out of 10, because I still feel like there's enough here for you to see, to check it out yourself. I know a lot of people, Brian, that outright hated it, that are going back for a second viewing, just like you did, because they want to give it another shot. They want to see what else is in there. It's a very intriguing movie. It's a very interesting movie to sit down and experience, but it is a mixed bag, more wrong than right, but 6 out of 10. Still check it out in my book to see for yourself.
I'll give it a 5 out of 10.
Oh.
It was just so profoundly disappointing. Being so excited for that first initial screening, I was literally like in my seat quaking. I was just so excited. And to be so utterly bored throughout the film was a disappointment, especially considering the level of talent involved. So, for those of you who like the movie, I completely understand why. For those of you who are confused after a first viewing and think that maybe going to see it a second time will help improve your opinion on the film, I'd say don't, because I did, and I didn't find the movie to be any more gratifying on that second watch. So
there it is, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah. I wish I liked it. I really, really wish I liked it.
Me too. But that's it. That's the end of it. We get disappointed once in a while, you know? That's the world of movies.
Well, speaking of disappointments, we have another movie to talk about.
That's why we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with Bryan Singer's
Pajama
Bohemian
Slumber Party.
Rhapsody.
Bryan Singer's Pool Party Massacre. After these messages.
We'll be right back.
This week in epic film history.
1, 2, 3, 4. Well, he sneaks into my house and he watches all my movies. From Bridget Jones's Diary to Never Been Kissed. He'll leave a message morning, and I hope that we can find him. Tell me, where in the world is
the Lisp?
Hey, Nick and Justin, this is Emily from the Classy Little Podcast, which has been on hiatus for a few weeks now. But after much coaxing from Nick, I'm back behind the mic because I need your help. The Lisp has started sneaking into my house to watch movies in the middle of the night, since apparently we both enjoy 80s and 90s movies. But then he leaves a mess for me to clean up in the morning. Hopefully you figured out that last week's movie was Rain Man. This week, it doesn't look like he watched a movie at all. All I found was a note that said this: Dear Epic Film Guys and listeners, I'm sure you're wondering where I'm headed and where you can find me. All I can say is the movies I've been watching in the previous 7 weeks will tell you where I'm going, so hopefully you paid attention to the titles. Does that answer your question? Sincerely yours, The Lisp. Can you and your listeners help me find The Lisp? Thanks, guys. Cheers.
Where in the world is
The Lisp?
Technically, I'm homeless.
For the sake of our fans, I might even drink straight dog piss, you know? I'd have to finish it, though. No one could ever see me because we don't do the live stream anymore, but maybe we'd have to make that like a live stream event, a special event, just so everyone could see that I have the balls to
Ladies and gentlemen, Justin drinks urine. Crickets. This would be my cricket sound effect in here. Drop the crickets. I sucked a dick last night.
It'd still be better than Bud Light, though.
Be about the same thing. They need to do better work than Marvel did, or even that they did themselves in fucking Suicide Squad with that garbage joke of a villain Enchantress with her fucking fun wavy arm dances. Like, ooh.
She's the wacky waving inflatable tube man.
Yeah. But, I just did the arm thing here. I don't know why.
I can picture you.
Audio only
wacky
format.
Wacky waving inflatable tube man. Enchantress. Buyers now.
I'm Justin, and I'm drinking a New England style IPA from Aslan Brewing. Nick, what do you got guzzling down your gullet this evening? Okay.
One of our main listeners, Mr. Dan Brennick, asked, why is Blue Moon, the beer, God's finest gift to our beautiful planet Earth? And
wrong.
Follow up, why are these bullshit microbreweries destroying such treasures as Bud Light Platinum? And follow up to the follow up, when did Zeus create the majesty known as pumpkin beer, and why has it single-handedly saved the beer industry? I have one answer to all three of those questions, Dan. Fuck you.
Welcome back, like officially, I guess, to the whole podcasting thing. Podcasting has not been better for having been without you for that few months. So it's wonderful to have you back. And if you guys haven't checked out her show, please do.
Somebody tweeted it like the final scene of The Force Awakens is going to be Kylo Ren removing the mask and the big floppy gunkin ears come falling out. And then Jar Jar goes, Misa gonna avenge you, Annie. And then it cuts to black.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, and as always, thank you very, very much for listening to the Epic Film Guys podcast, and thank you to Justin and the Souse for your review of Suspiria, the film that will never open in my market, so I'll never have to worry about not having seen it.
I'm sorry. Hey, I'm so sorry.
We are going to talk about Bryan Singer's Bohemian Rhapsody, the Queen biopic, starring Rami Malek as Freddie Mercury, a bunch of other people as a bunch of paper-thin characters that nobody cares about because they're not important, and a whole bunch of Queen music. So, Justin, what's it about?
The movie's about Freddie Mercury at its core. That's really what it's all about, which I'm actually really surprised about, but we'll get into that when we start talking about how we felt about the film. But the one thing that I have to say right off the bat is, if you're a Queen fan, you've already seen this movie. So you already know what it's about.
100%.
Even if you're not a Queen fan, you've seen this movie. If you've seen any movie ever, you've seen Bohemian Rhapsody. If you've seen any musical biopic, if you've seen Walk Hard: The Dewey Cox Story, which is an infinitely more well-rounded and entertaining biopic than this is, then you've seen this movie. You've seen Bohemian Rhapsody. But there has been a lot of interest in this movie because of the director, Bryan Singer, who is a pedophile rapist and should never direct a film ever again. But that's besides the point. He directed about, well, reports say about 50% of this movie before he was booted off. And Dexter Fletcher, who directed the film Eddie the Eagle, which I found to be very entertaining, stepped in. It's also executive produced by Brian May and Roger Taylor, of course, members of the band Queen. So I was curious about how their influence would affect the film, because initially, when Sacha Baron Cohen was attached to the project to play Freddie Mercury, he clashed with the vision that the bandmates had for the film and the story that it would tell. So this movie's been in development for about a decade or so, right?
Give or take, yeah. Going back to, I think, like 2010 or so. Yeah,
originally 2010 it was announced originally. Yeah.
So, I mean, and I talked about it numerous times on the show, but Sacha Baron Cohen went on the Howard Stern show after he had walked away from the film. And, I mean, essentially, originally the vision for this film is they wanted Freddie Mercury to die halfway through it, and then they wanted the rest of the film to be about the rest of Queen dealing with the aftermath of that. A film that literally not one person wants to see. No one
Thank God they didn't make that.
Ever. And I think reportedly they also clashed because Baron Cohen wanted the film to be more adult, whereas May and Taylor really wanted the film to be more family friendly.
Rated PG-13, which makes sense.
Yeah.
Which makes sense.
It sells records. Let's make no mistake here. The members of Queen that had involvement with this had veto rights on this movie. That much has been confirmed.
Oh, yeah.
And they're still alive. They want to sell records. They want that wallet in their pocket to grow fatter when this movie's released. So they're going to have a say about it. It is an issue with the film, which we're going to get to, but I understand it. When there's a movie about a musician that's been dead for 10 years, 20 years, 30, 40 years, you know, their estate has a say in it, but like, they're not going to make that much of a percentage as the person that's still alive that owns, you know, ownership over some of the music. Yeah,
this film never would have happened because if not for the involvement of Roger Taylor and Brian May, this film doesn't happen because you don't get access to Queen's library. And
think about this,
the crux of it right there.
Think about this. Parents will take their kids to it, and some of those kids might not have ever heard Queen before. So the fact that they're being exposed to Queen's amazing library of music, the fact that this movie exists does not bother me at all. I get why the film is made the way that it is. I guess we'll get to that.
I'm going to step in there because I'm also okay with the film existing, and I understand why the film is made the way that it is, but that does not excuse it from being a colossal piece of shit. It's fucking terrible.
It's not terrible.
I wrote it over on Twitter after I watched the film. You can basically just queue up the Queen Wikipedia page, put on their greatest hits, and take a read, because that's all the fucking screenwriters for this film did.
Can I ask you a question, though?
This thing is toothless. It doesn't get any depth out of anything whatsoever. It's all so fucking surface level, so scoured, so sanitized. You get nothing out of anything in this fucking movie. When I watch a biopic, I want to learn things. I want to get into these characters. I want to understand who these characters were. These characters, except for Freddie Mercury in this film, these characters are all fucking paper thin. They're caricatures. They're basically just fucking set dressing for the entire runtime of the fucking film. Toothless.
That's 100% fine with me, because the movie's about Freddie Mercury. The movie isn't about Queen. The movie is Freddie Mercury. And Rami Malek is absolutely mesmerizing in this performance. One of my top five favorite male performances of the entire year. I could not take my eyes off of him. Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. And you know what, Nick? I get what you're saying. But you say when you see a biopic, you want all these things? Well, it's unfortunate for you because only one out of five, one out of maybe 10 gives you that. So your chances are very, very off. They're not going to happen that often.
Well, Justin, you're talking specifically about musical biopics, right?
Yes, I am, because we're dealing with a musical biopic.
again, that's why Walk Hard, the Dewey Cox story.
I haven't seen it, so I understand where you're going with that. But
that movie lampoons every single thing that this movie does in such a way that the fact that this movie is coming out after Dewey Cox is like a joke, because it's almost
many,
like parody.
How many of those families that you referenced earlier on have seen that? How many of those families that are taking their children to experience Queen for the first time have seen that? Hardly any of them.
Well, right.
So
but that's
the, how
why
is that, this... how is that movie relevant to the people that are going out to see this movie now?
Well, it's not necessarily, but I'm talking about biopics in general, that this is just safe and bland and formulaic, and it goes through all of the beats that you would expect to see in a movie like this. And just,
yep.
It's so simplistic. It's not even that it's paint by numbers, which it is.
It is.
But it's simplistic, like the way everything is framed. So you see Freddie Mercury watching Brian May and Roger Taylor performing, cut to a scene of them saying, oh, we lost our lead singer. And then Freddie Mercury walks up, they start talking, he's like, oh, we lost our lead singer. And Freddie Mercury says, oh, I'll be your lead singer. Cut to the next scene where he's singing in the band. And it's just, it's so connect the dots in a way that is just so painfully bland. It kind of insults your intelligence a little bit. Like, there's this, like, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, like, jokiness to it all. Like, oh, this song will never be successful. Cut to the next scene where it's a big smash hit.
This, okay. You know what this film was? And Justin will disagree. I know he will. But this film was like, if the Twilight writer, Stephanie Meyer, wrote a Queen biopic, it's instead of the film, like, there's all these scenes of them telling us that the Queen band members are family, but they never show us that. They never show us these characters coming together. They never show us these characters developing together, growing that brotherhood, that sense of family. So you don't feel that when they say it. It
you do
ring
with
true.
The music.
It rings
you do when they're making
fun.
The music.
But I'm already a Queen fan. I already love Queen. I don't need them to sell me Queen music. So I'm not coming to
no,
this
but I'm
as
saying,
somebody.
I'm saying
who
specifically
needs to be sold
the scenes
Queen
with
music.
Them making the music, Nick, because I know both
the
of you ever,
the
have never
music
done this
don't
before.
Tell you anything
but I've made,
about
I've
them
made
making
albums.
The music.
I've made demos. That's where the magic happens.
They don't tell you anything about the characters making the music. There's nothing about
you
their
see
thought
it.
Process.
You're experiencing
There's
it.
Nothing about it in the film. It's literally just
how
intangible.
Is it? There's scenes with them recording the music. There's scenes of them recording the songs.
It's intangible. There's nothing about their thought process. Like them being together just thinking and brainstorming and talking.
Look, there's a scene where Freddie Mercury walks in. He's arguing with Brian and Roger, and the bassist, Deacon. He starts out of nowhere, and there's no context for this. In the middle of the argument, he starts playing the bass line to Another One Bites the Dust, just out of nowhere. And then Freddie goes, oh, I like that bass line. Cut to them performing it live. And it's like...
But do you realize that's how music is made, though? That's how people come up with ideas.
To
you
me,
just jam and it just comes out like that. That's happened to me a million times with writing songs.
To me, it feels like they were so desperate to include all of Queen's greatest hits. That's what it feels like. It feels like a cynical, slickly overproduced infomercial, basically.
Cynical.
Where it's like, it does feel cynical to me because like we have to include Another One Bites the Dust. We have to include, you know, the I Want to Break Free music video. And they sacrifice storytelling in favor of this is where Another One Bites the Dust should be in the story because there's an argument breaking out. And to
how
me,
many fans, if they walked out not hearing that song, you know how upset they would be?
This movie is great for Queen fans because Queen fans can go in and go, oh, I recognize this song. I like this movie.
And they love it. And I saw them fist pumping and I saw them cheering during it.
That's great. I'm so happy for them.
I think I'm happy for them, too, because I was one of them. And I think that the live performances, the recreations of those live performances was done brilliantly, amazingly. The cinematography, how it felt like I was at a Queen show in the late 70s. It felt like I was at Live Aid, which we'll get to.
It has a lot of energy to the direction.
It has a great energy, an amazing energy to it. And I get what you guys are saying. I'm not disagreeing that it's paint by numbers. I'm not disagreeing that it's run of the mill. But my point of view is we get so many of them. This is one of the better of them that we've gotten.
The Live Aid performance for me, because I adore the Live Aid performance. I just sit and I watch it and I just listen to it. And to just watch Freddie and actual Queen like during that performance it's mesmerizing. And they did a really great job in the film recreating it. But like the whole time I'm watching it, I'm just like, like the film, the problem is the film gives me nothing that just going to YouTube and watching the actual Live Aid performance doesn't already give me. And that's the problem with a lot of the stuff in this film, is that the film doesn't give me anything new. I already love Queen. I already adore this music. The film doesn't need to sell it to me. So what I wanted to see, and what I hoped to see, in spite of knowing that the Queen members had their executive producer privilege, I wanted to see some character depth. I wanted to see some of the brotherhood, of the camaraderie of these four guys that created one of literally the greatest rock and roll bands to ever walk the fucking planet. That's what I wanted to see, and it didn't give it to me, especially with the other three members of Queen. They're literally scent dressing. They're literally scent dressing.
Which surprises me. It does surprise me, because they're involved. They had to have made the decision to say, let's make this Freddy's movie, because they could have said, honestly, no, it really surprised me. I really thought that them being involved was going to initiate them being a larger part of the story.
That's like, exactly what I thought,
equal
too.
To Freddy. But after I watched the movie and I experienced the runtime and I experienced it as a whole, I didn't see anywhere where the movie could have included more of them, with it still being the movie that they've actually given to us in theaters. It could have been longer and we could have gotten it. But I think that I feel like they knew, and the studio knew, and the producers knew, everyone cares about Freddie because he's the icon. Queen's still touring, dude. Queen's still touring with Adam Lambert. Queen still puts out shows. Queen still puts out albums. But you know what everyone goes back to? The Mercury era. Like, no one's rushing out to buy the new Queen album right now. But right now, they're buying Bohemian Rhapsody on iTunes by the fucking thousands because of this movie. And they know that. And I think they're better off just saying, hey,
and I think that
in their mind.
100%, I think you just hit the nail on the head, because I think ultimately when you watch this film, I think that really, great as Rami Malek is aside, I think that that's all this film was really designed to do. It was designed to sell Queen records. And
that's why I said it feels cynical to me.
I just don't, like I said, for me, like, it feels toothless. It doesn't get into the depth that I feel like was there, and you could have just easily just spent more time with these characters so I could understand, so I could be part of that journey. I'm not part of that journey. I felt disconnected from it the whole time. And as a viewer, I don't want to be disconnected from characters. I want to be invested, connected, and there.
I have problems with the way that his sexuality was depicted in the film. I know that it was kind of a point of contention of how much they would delve into that necessarily in the film. And I was excited that they didn't completely sanitize it. But to me, and Justin disagreed with this, but as a queer person myself, I felt that the depiction of gay people in the movie was like sinister in a way that made me feel really uncomfortable.
Are they not?
I mean, I know it was a different time.
I love
it was
you,
this. I love you too. Not in the gay way, though. No homo.
I've had you, so.
Jesus Christ. Anyway,
yeah, all of the instances. Let's see you pick up and run with it from there.
As I was saying before, I was rudely interrupted.
Oh my god.
All of the instances of homosexuality in the film are predatory. Paul Prenter, who was Freddy's lover at one point, played by Alan Leach in the film, he basically assaults Freddy initially, and then they become lovers, and then Paul like drags him down into this like partying lifestyle that ruins his life, and he conspires to get Freddy a solo career to break up the band, which never ever happened.
Yeah, never
in real life. This was like, this movie needed a villain. Let's make it the gay lover. And yes, Paul Prenter did eventually out Freddie Mercury in a way that was not appropriate.
He was still a giant piece of shit, because he sold their like all sorts of shit about Freddie to the tabloids after their affair ended. Yeah,
very unscrupulous. But not only that, but just I feel like the film equates Freddie's homosexuality with his downfall in the film, and the way that his gay lifestyle is the reason why the band broke up, almost, in a way.
See, I don't feel like it was that. I feel like maybe it was just a reflection of the time, as you said earlier on, because during the 80s, it was a very, very scary time to be a homosexual because the AIDS situation was extremely high. People were being killed left and right by this disease, and they had no idea how to handle it. Like, doctors didn't know how to handle it. And we see that reflected in the movie. I didn't take it as being evil. I've never had that kind of disease, nor have you. So I don't know what it would feel like for us to go back in that time and be in that situation. And I feel like that the moment where Freddie actually goes in, even though it's not the right time within the timeline of when it really happened, but I felt emotion during that scene. How would that feel for you, knowing that you're this icon? And make no mistake, Freddie's a very cocky character in this movie, because in real life, he was that way, to find out, I've only got this much time to live. I mean, obviously, it wasn't the early 80s. It was the late 80s when he found out, and that's when he died. But I felt like those scenes, there were little bits and pieces, guys, where for me, as far as what Rami Malek did as Freddie Mercury, it hit home with me, because he gave such a great performance and he put his heart into this character, and he obviously cared so much that regardless of how weak the script was in parts, he really gave it his all and he really tried. And I think that's what won me over with this movie.
Malek is amazing. You said it. I mean,
I gotta tell you this though. One of my biggest issues I had with the movie, I got to hear from both of you. It took me 25 minutes to get over him in the beginning of the movie. I'm like, I don't know if I can watch this movie. The fucking prosthetic teeth, the dentures. I didn't know if I could do it, man. He's doing this the whole time, and I'm like, I don't know if I can do this. Well, I was on board with it.
It was fine to me, because that's how Freddie Mercury really looked.
He had really big teeth.
I know he did, I feel like they gave Rami like bigger teeth than he needed, so they're like sticking out of. He's like, he had like really hard time with them in the beginning of the movie. I don't know.
I think you just got used. You had to get used to it.
I got over it within 20 minutes, but I was like, man, they're fucking huge. Like, they fucking took some teeth out of a horse. They killed the horse, and they pulled the teeth out of the horse's mouth, and they put them in his mouth.
You've just described Freddie Mercury. But yeah, no, he exudes like that swagger that Mercury had. And there are also, you know, those vulnerabilities, the weird twitches and stuff. Like, if you watch interviews with Freddie Mercury, he has those mannerisms that Malek just embodies perfectly. Obviously, a lot of research and preparation went into this performance, and all the concert stuff, studied his movements and stuff
was just insane. Like, like you never feel like when he's moving. I think that's the most successful part of his performance. It's not the dramatic scenes. It's not anything else. It's the way that he moves, because he really does move like Freddie Mercury moved, and I think that to be able to capture at least that was a resounding success, because like that's Mercury was like the consummate showman. Like, he got on that fucking stage and he put on a show and a half, and you never for a moment doubt that Malek is not completely channeling that in those scenes when he's on stage. Not even close. You know, it's crazy to me to see him, because there were, when I talk about earlier, when the hearing, the singing broke the immersion for me, but just watching the movements, if you're just looking at him, totally immersed in it. It's just when I like, and I can't disassociate those two things in my brain enough to be like, I get it, whatever. Like, that's, I get it. But the movement that he does, especially like Brian, I think you're about to talk about the Live Aid performance, especially, that's something that I've watched 100 times. So like the movements that he's doing up on the fucking stage, and the way that he struts around the stage holding the half of a mic stand, he's Freddie in those scenes. He's 100%
Freddie Mercury. The way that he performed, it was sexy, and Rami Malek is sexy in this film. Just that, like the way he kind of struts about, like, he know, like, there's that confidence, there's that command of the stage, and the Live Aid's performance is extremely well done, and it does leave you on a high as you leave the theater. It is triumphant, it is powerful. I think it's just undercut by everything else, and just kind of how cheap the lead up to it feels, where it's like Freddie Mercury kind of comes back and is basically like begging the band to reunite for this performance. And again, like, that never happened. It's just dramatic, you know.
Yeah, they did it all for dramatic, because they had to
it's a movie, I get it.
They have to.
I just Yeah, I was there with you, Lois. So I was watching those scenes. I was just like head cocked to the side just a little bit, like really?
It made me feel uncomfortable.
Yeah.
The first third of this movie was painful for me to get through. I'm not going to lie to you guys, because it just goes breakneck speed. All right. Like you said earlier, Loisos, so he meets the band members. Next minute, he's at the club playing in the band. Next minute, they're already on tour. Next minute, they're already in the studio recording their first album. Next minute, they're already big and they're dealing with Mike Myers. And I you could say all you want about that scene, Loisos. I loved Mike Myers in this fucking movie. And I fucking loved that Wayne's World reference. I don't give a shit. I thought it was hilarious. The whole crowd erupted. You're the only one sitting in that theater that was like...
That's actually a very accurate representation of me watching a movie. Because
everyone else, literally, everyone's like clapping and cheering and stuff. I thought it was funny.
But yeah, the crowd had a great time.
I think once they become Queen and they're already on tour and they're doing their thing, that's when I started enjoying it more. But no, believe me, like this movie is not perfect. It's very, very, very far from it. And I'm seeing a lot of people, guys, that are saying it's the best film of the year. It's like 5 stars out of 5. And I don't agree with that. I have a lot of issues with this movie. It is paint by numbers. It is traditional biopic. It doesn't stretch the genre in any way. But for what it is and me going into it just expecting nothing, nothing at all, I was just intrigued by what I got on screen and seeing the audience at that theater actually stomping their foot, dun dun ch, dun dun ch, and they're doing it like not even knowing that they're doing it, and they're actually fist pumping like this, like holding themselves back from getting into the music, and you know this music means so much to them because we all grew up with it. I haven't gone to a hockey game or a baseball game or any kind of sport event without hearing Queen played my entire life. Like my dad played it in the car all the time, every single day that I drive to work on the radio, Queen plays. So I hear it every day. Like it's part of all of us. And I know there's a lot of huge fans, way bigger fans than I am. But I feel like for the most part, about 65% of it, they got it right.
Yeah, but I feel like people enjoying the music and getting into the music is not a credit to the film. It's a credit to the band.
They recreated it. They could have just went with a black screen and played the music. They recreated the live performances. And that's something that they're doing. I feel like it's very special, to, like you said earlier, Nick, young people that will never get to go back and watch Queen play with Freddie Mercury. This is their way of
saying... Except on YouTube.
Yeah, but again, they're making the movie anyways. They're making the movie anyways. Yes, they could just go, let's put the YouTube footage into theaters.
Yeah,
it wouldn't play. They could do a documentary of just the footage.
But it that wouldn't be
play.
Financial.
A movie would play. A movie did play, and it just broke records. It's like the number two biggest biopic of all time. So that's the power of what this thing is, and I understand it, and I respect it, even though I have a lot of issues with it, and I understand your guys' viewpoints on it as well.
Like I said, I really, really do enjoy the live concert recreations, but I agree 100% with Loisos that's not a credit to the film. That's a credit to the power of Queen. Like that's just the power of Queen's music to transcend like generations. Like when Wayne's World came out, Bohemian Rhapsody charted on the Billboard charts again. It's the only song that's ever sold a million copies twice in its entire history.
Right.
Like it during two different releases. Like that's the power of Queen. And I think that the music is so good and it's so intoxicating. So stamp it, put the number on it. Give it to me, baby.
You know what, guys? I liked it. I didn't love it. I don't think it's one of the best biopics ever, but I was immersed in that world. I fist pumped. I'm giving it a 7 out of 10.
Jesus Christ. 4 out of 10. Buy Queen's Greatest Hits. Go to YouTube. Watch the 20-minute performance of Live Aid featuring just original Queen, and just... head to their Wikipedia page and read all of just the surface level factoids.
Anyone can edit Wikipedia, Nick. You probably just went on there and edited it to make it more like the movie to confuse people.
No, that's what I'm saying. I'm making a point that the film is as surface level as a Wikipedia article. It doesn't dig into any depth. It just gives you bullet points, factoids that you need to hit. Bullet points.
You just wanted to see Mercury's dick go into another. You wanted to see a dick go into a mouth.
I did not care about that whatsoever. I wanted to see a lot of character depth, especially from the other members of Queen, who I really feel like it was baffling to me that they were so just, they were set dressing. They were just paper thin, just pointless characters. Just pointless. 4 out of 10. I do not recommend it. Just buy Queen's Greatest Hits. You're going to get the same exact thing out of just listening to Queen's Greatest Hits as you would watching this movie. 100%.
I think the Wikipedia article would be more truthful than...
It was. Strangely enough.
I'm not really going into this movie expecting it to be 100% historically accurate, because of course that would be ridiculous. I guess what I wanted from it was something that wasn't like every movie ever made. I admire a lot about the film. It is very well directed, very well put together. The live performances are very faithfully recreated. Rami Malek deserved a movie that is 1,000 times better than this, because his performance is... If you're going to plop down $12 to go see this film, it'll be for Rami Malek's performance. He is electrifying on screen.
And, worth my price of admission.
He's, you know, easy on the eyes, and of course the music. Of course the, you know, Rami Malek, if you're listening, call me. You know,
what do you mean if?
I mean, we know he's going to be listening.
Right?
Nick is right. It's akin to skimming the Wikipedia article about Freddie Mercury while occasionally glancing up to watch, you know, Queen performances. And I just think it's ironic that one of the most, you know, audacious and unconventional rock icons of all time is the subject of the most bland film you could possibly imagine. So I'm going to give Bohemian Rhapsody...
That clapping is the same clapping I heard with people in the theater, so after watching the movie. So
people,
you
know,
doing
what?
That.
People loved it, and I'm not going to take that away from them, but I'm going to give Bohemian Rhapsody... I've given all the movies tonight a 5 out of 10, just because all of them are just as middle of the road, or as... just like, I don't really know what to... How to make my mind up about them. 5 out of 10 for me for Bohemian Rhapsody. Bro-hemian Rhapsody.
I didn't see any bros in that movie.
Oh.
It's a Blink-182 song, but anyhow.
And there it is, ladies and gentlemen, so... Your mileage may vary on Bohemian Rhapsody. Let us know what you thought about it, of course, when we post up the episode live this Thursday. And make up your own mind about it. Like Justin, you can definitely go into it with that perspective. And I think there, you know, you could walk out of it with a completely different
the different pee-pee in your pants. You could walk into this movie and you will have one pee-pee in your pants, and then when you leave, you'll have a different pee-pee in there. Who knows what's going to happen? You might even have a pee-pee in your mouth.
Oh, my God. But ladies and gentlemen, that is, unfortunately, all the time we have for this week's show. So, yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, we love you. Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you.
You guys are amazing. You guys are the lifeblood. You guys are why we continue to do this thing 3.5 years strong. We're coming up on it's Justin is just showing his buck teeth on the camera.
He's doing like a Nicolas Cage and Vampire's Kiss face over here.
That really, really is the face. That's 100%. Pull up that gif of Nicolas Cage going, "You don't say." And that's the face that Justin was making on the camera there. But we love you. Head over, of course, to the Hopesters Dumpster, facebook.com/groups/epicfilmguys, and join in. You get to win prizes. We give away prizes over in the dumpster. You get to join the Never Seen It November Challenge, ladies and gentlemen.
It's
a lot of fun. And again, we are going to be giving away prizes for it. You can also catch live broadcasts of episodes periodically. I'm still working on doing that a little bit more on the reg. Justin's touching his nipples once again. But we really, really love you. Find us on every, and I mean every, podcatcher under the sun. We're hosted, of course, over on Podbean, Apple Podcasts. Please rate, review, and subscribe to the show. We'd really, really appreciate it. We would love you.
And check us out on all of our social media.
5-star reviews, and you get a week with your very own loy sauce to do whatever.
He doesn't look too happy about that. Nick, he doesn't look too happy about that. The look on his face,
I never agreed to this.
You know what? We're going to get a 5-star review from Brian Singer tomorrow.
He'll be happy. You know what? He's going to be asking all about you. He's going to look up your name. If you check the hashtag loy sauce, which he probably will on Twitter and on Instagram, he'll see your picture and he'll immediately be happy on the prize he's going to receive. Oh, that's God. His Thanksgiving. He has something to give thanks for now.
Yeah, we really, really appreciate everybody out there listening. Follow us on social media, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter @EpicFilmGuys. We love you, and we've got legitimately a ton more content to throw at you guys this month. We've got Creed 2 coming up this month. We've got Fantastic Beasts 2, The Crimes of Grindelwald, a whole shitload of Harry Potter movies that we've got to get into. Hopefully I'll get to see Overlord if it opens here. The Girl in the Spiders, fuck that movie, I don't even fucking care.
With the tramp stamp tattoo. The chick that you banged at the bar that you want to forget about.
It's your crazy drunken knight coming back to haunt you? What? No.
It's Claire Foy.
I'm sure Claire Foy is going to be amazing.
She's not Rooney Mara.
She's amazing.
She's a great actress, but she doesn't look like Rooney Mara does. So, yeah.
I don't think it's meant to be like a continuation of the Fincher film or like a sequel to it. I think it's just meant to be its own thing, isn't it?
It's a reboot.
But there's no reason.
I love Fincher's Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, so it'll be hard for me to disassociate myself with that film.
See, Nick hates it. I like it.
I fucking hate it. It's a fucking piece of shit.
It's not. He's gonna kill
you. You know what? Loisos was saying earlier during this Suspiria review, he was saying it's so boring, and that's Fincher's Girl with the Dragon Tattoo to me, because it's Daniel Craig pretending he's a detective, which, Jesus Christ, stick to Bond. Stick to what you know. Because
he's a great actor. He has
one fucking range, and it's just Bond.
Also, Logan Lucky.
He's great in Logan Lucky. Nick didn't watch it, so he doesn't know. He's actually really good. I couldn't believe how good he was in that. You're going to call this anyway. But
that's why in the trailer it says, introducing Daniel Craig. Because it's like, here's a role that he's never played before, and he's great.
And you can't believe it's him. So he's no Bond in that movie.
But yeah, we love you, ladies and gentlemen. So thank you all very, very, very much for listening. For myself, for Justin, for the god of podcasting himself.
That's a lot of cum.
I don't know what that has to do with anything, but okay. Thank you all very, very, very much for listening. And of course, ladies and gentlemen,
we will see you
at the movies.
I want to see kid get strangled.
Just had to throw that last little bit in there, didn't he? Just he can't stop with the memeing.
Dude, when I hear that though, I don't picture the face you're making now, Brian. I picture you just doing this straight face, like looking at a child, like I want to see a kid get strangled.
Wasn't I like banging my fist, like I want to see a kid get strangled.
I think I was it's like one really. Of them. Hang on, let's wait.
I want to see a kid get stabbed.
Wait.
I want to see a kid get decapitated.
He was really decapitating a child during that one.
I want to see a kid get strangled.
I think he was really strangling a kid during that one. So yeah, I think it's... yeah.
I'm really glad you cut those sound bites
out. I told you.
Now it just sounds like I'm a psychopath.
I mean, it did
I hope that
already.
I hope no one from Draft House listens to the show and they hear that. Oh man, we have a creative manager that talks about cum and wanting to strangle small children.
I sucked a dick last night.
I mean, you can't stop him. He's unstoppable. It's either penises or strangling kids. You can't.
This is why you have this reputation. I think girls are just scared of you, Brian.
That's why no one matches me on Tinder.
Boom. That's a show, ladies and gentlemen.
There we are.
There's literally a scene where Freddie Mercury comes in. Yeah, he starts arguing with Brian May. And then the bassist, Tim, right? Tim is the bassist?
John Deacon.
Deacon, sorry. I'm going to take that again.
He was played by Little Timmy from Jurassic Park.
He's played by Timmy from Jurassic Park. That's where you were going with that.
That's what it is. Sorry.
Because, hey, the kid's working now. So
yeah, sorry. So